Morale on 19th August 76 at Cambridge. Well, before we discuss your first work here at the Cavendish Laboratory, could you just tell me what your background was before then?
Well, I took my degree in Oxford in 39, just a couple of months before the war started. And immediately the war started, those of us that, that had any experience of electronics, as it might call, were mysteriously whisked away into the radar game. And there I stayed for 6 years, so autumn 45.
With your degree in physics?
Yes.
Right. And this was, I think, at the TRE, was the name?
TRE, yes.
Right.
Which is concerned with the development of, well, I was concerned with airborne radar and countermeasures.
And I suspect this was rather useful in terms of the techniques that you learned and so forth for radio astronomy.
I think this may be somewhat overemphasized, this point always. I think it was very important. I mean, one stopped doing physics for 6 years, and physics almost evaporated by 1945. But one learned a lot of engineering, what things could work.
Right.
And of course, one learned a lot about people, and that was important too.
Right. But you think the point is overemphasized, that the development of radar and the people that learned it really is what made radio astronomy take off after the war, at least in some places?
Well, obviously one did learn, there were techniques that had evolved in radar which were obviously useful. I mean, low noise receivers had gone quite a way. I was working with antennas quite a bit, and that obviously was very important. But a lot of these things, you know, weren't all that clever. They were, mm-hmm. they were basic things, but the important thing is you've got a feel for what was practical, what could be made.
I see.
No, obviously one had learnt a lot about various techniques, but in fact the actual straight transfer of technology to radio astronomy wasn't, I think, as important as it often made out. Obviously one gained a lot from bits of radar equipment, which would be much too expensive to build with the sort of budgets that one had in universities just after the war, which is virtually nil.
So you're saying that it was more the methodology or more just a feel for what could be done in the area,
Yes, I think that was really the most things. Important thing. And of course it was an incredibly good training, this wartime work. I mean, it wasn't a method of training, but
right.
I mean, the people, the small group of people that was at TRE, the proportion that have gone to the tops of their professions in all sorts of different fields is remarkably non-statistical.
Right.
And
right.
This has nothing to do with being clever people that were brought into the game. It's because the training was very good.
Right, very intense, I guess 6 years altogether.
You had enormous, right. Yes, it was 6 years. You had enormous responsibilities at an early age. You had to make decisions. There was nobody to ask because you knew more about it than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And this was sort of thing which one ought to do in a PhD program, if you think of how to do it
right.
without having another war.
Well, so the war ended, and then what was your next move?
Well, I got the possibility of one of these temporary fellowship things, which were set up to come to get people back into universities, which were of course in a rather rundown state by mm-hmm. then. And so I came back to Cambridge with Jack Ratcliffe, who had been running an ionospheric group before the war. He also had been at TRE, so we kept in touch, and we started off observing the sun. The particular point was that at that time the sun had been observed at times of great activity at meter wavelengths, and it had been observed at all times at centimeter wavelengths.
Right.
So the first thing we set out to see was, well, it was in fact the sun there all the time at meter wavelengths, and so we built a rather more sensitive equipment and a better antenna system for doing this.
Not knowing what intensity level it would be at.
No, you were just making a system as good as you could.
Right.
And we used an interferometer to distinguish between the contribution from the relatively compact source of the sun, compact in those days, to distinguish that from the galaxy. And this was the purpose of using an interferometer, which we rapidly extended to measure the angular dimensions of the sunspot sources and show that they were in fact a few minutes of arc only.
Now when you say we, you mean yourself and Varnberg?
Yes, that was just the two of us. Varnberg had also been at TRE, and he came back, now I can't recall what state he was in, whether he had completed his his undergraduate course, because during the war the undergraduate courses were chopped off at 2 years and people tended to go back and do 1 year more. Anyway, he started out a little after me. I can't remember the exact date, but we had some sort of equipment going, I suppose, by early 46.
Now, let's take this for an example, the first Michelson interferometer in radio astronomy, which you just talked about. Was that idea something that was apparent from any work that had been done in radar, or was it did you ever have to, for instance, discriminate between a point-like source and a background?
It didn't arise that way. It arose, I think, because I don't think it arose by analogy with an optical Michelson, because, as I said, one had forgotten all the physics by then.
Mm-hmm.
I think it arose from the idea that if you have a null by interference between two aerials out in antiphase, then this could fairly easily tell you something about a compact source, and as you make that null narrow by separating the elements, I suppose we were reinventing the Michelson interferometer, as it were, but I think it came from a sort of a rather simple-minded thinking of aerials rather than saying, I remember in my physics book.
Well, that's interesting, right. Well, let me also ask, when you came here, how was it that you chose radio astronomy? I mean, was this basically Radcliffe's idea or your own idea? Or?
During the last weeks of the months of the war, he had suggested I might come back to Cambridge. Of course, he was very anxious to build up a research team, because these are people are going to have to teach undergraduates as well. And there was, as I say, a very rundown state in Cavendish at that time. And I had already told him that I wasn't terribly excited about the ionospheric physics side of things. I thought, well, wrongly, of course, as it turned out, that there wasn't too much more to do in that field.
Uh-huh.
But in any case, this seemed a more exciting one, the fact that there had been his observations, his wartime observations of the sun, and more observations of the galactic background, which clearly were interesting.
Okay, now, did you know about Jansky and Rieber's observations then at this time, late in the war?
I don't think we knew about Jansky, and I should think we probably didn't know about Rieber. One didn't read literature during the war. There wasn't time for it. One was living on a very short time scale, of course. There were things which had to be done in weeks.
Oh, sure.
And get into aeroplanes and fly. And that time didn't allow one the luxury of keeping up to date with the literature. Anyway, there wasn't very much. I think probably it had been triggered off by the work of Hay. Mm-hmm. There were two bits of it. One was the rediscovery of the importance of the existence of the galactic background as it affected the limiting sensitivity which radar receivers could reach.
Right.
That was a thing which happened at TRE, I remember.
That must have been someone coming across Jansky's paper or something, or was
no,
it?
No,
it was measured.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, you were trying to make receivers better and better, and they didn't get any better. They measured better on the bench, but they didn't get better when you stuck them on an antenna.
And so this was completely independent of Jansky's work, as far as you know.
Oh, I think so, because, I mean, people weren't interested in what had been done in some way. I think it's quite a low, I mean, it's a low frequency anyway. You see, this is now in the 200 megacycle region, where ground-grid triodes and things were coming in. And these, the people that invented these receivers on the bench said, this is a marvelous receiver, it's this much better than the previous one.
Took it
up and put it in the radar, and it wasn't. The range wasn't increased significantly. And this is because, at that time, you'd been able to get the receiver noise in the 200 megacycle region, down to levels where the galactic background began to matter.
So
that, in a sense, was a rediscovery by people that were just concerned with increasing the range of a radar set.
Right.
Now, that, of course, it was immediately tied up with people that had recalled pre-war things, I imagine. Well, I wasn't one of them, because I wasn't aware of it. But that was one thing. The second thing was the work that Hay did, again, observing, well, he did two things. He observed the meter wave radiation from the sun, which was discovered again accidentally in an operational radar system. He also observed variation of the system noise, as we would now call it, with azimuth. Mm-hmm. It was a horizontally looking radar, but by plotting the azimuth distribution at various times of day, he was able to draw out a crude map of the galaxy, which again I don't know whether or not he'd read of Chomsky's work or not. He may well have, because he was older than me, and therefore he would have been in research before the war.
And was this during the war? You're talking about Hayes.
Yes.
Sleeping. So yes. This is not the thing that he published in 1946 or so, or the first map, Hay, Phillips, and Parsons.
That's right. Well, that was the one. I mean, that was it was done just towards the end of the war, I think. It wasn't published until after the war.
I see. Now, do you think that there might be some reports at TRE describing this effect of the galactic noise being the limiting thing? That would be very interesting to me to see what they had to say at that time.
I doubt it.
What you say, it was sort of common knowledge amongst those who needed to know.
Well, you see, I think you've got altogether a too academic view of what that period was like.
Okay.
I mean, you say it was common knowledge that this was an effect which happened. It wasn't that at all. You say, for Pete's sake, how can I increase the range of this radar a little bit, or whatever it may be? And that's the best you can do. Right, that's the best you can do. And get on and do it, you see. And you install it and you get on. I mean, there's aeroplanes depending on it.
So you're saying there's no time to write a report to disseminate it?
No. I mean, they might have at some time written a report, but I should think it's not very likely.
I see what you're saying.
I mean, it was a different sort of life altogether.
Right.
The amount of paper flowing is rather small.
Rather much more enjoyable in that respect, anyway.
Now, the other thing, of course, which had happened during this time was that I think it was Southworth, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know whether that was an accidental radar discovery or not.
That was purposeful. He had a small dish and he actually detected the sun at three different miles
Yes.
away.
Yes. Well, that clearly did owe a lot to radar development, because there wouldn't have been any receivers there
right.
if it hadn't been for centimeter radar developments.
Right.
So that was one wouldn't have known about that until radar. Well, of course, it's really back to the invention of the magnetron too, because if there hadn't been a magnetron, there would have been centimeter radar, and people wouldn't have made good mixes.
That's true too, right? But now you say that Radcliffe, of course, he had worked in the ionosphere, but you weren't interested in the ionosphere. So how did this other option come up?
Oh well, these various things we knew of Hayes' work. And we'd read of Southworth's work by then, I think, hadn't we?
Well, you may have had a report from the radar rad lab in the States or Mel Labs.
Yes, I think we had heard of that about the end of the war. And just these things looked, they might be interesting.
I see. But Radcliffe himself didn't want to particularly work in this field.
No, he obviously felt that there was, as indeed he was right, that there was a lot more to do in the ionosphere with techniques which were now obviously could be greatly improved.
So the first thing you did was, as you've already said, set up this microcenterferometer, establish that there were small, less than 10 arc minutes burst into the first paper, is what you say.
Yes.
And also that it was circularly polarized, which is a rather interesting sort of thing. Why did it strike you that would be something to measure, or was it just you were trying to measure everything you could on this strange radiation?
I can't recall whether at that time anybody else had measured circular polarization.
Well, I don't think so. Probably you didn't know anyway. In Nature, within 2 weeks, there were three papers, Appleton, Hay, yourself, and Von Berg, and who was the other one? Martin and somebody.
Yes.
So apparently all these people had the idea. I'm just wondering what motivated you.
Well, I think quite likely we did realize that if you put... I thought I remember we did it with an interferometer with opposite polarizations,
right.
Which would, of course, shown up whether it was linear polarized or circular, and found that it was pretty well pure circular.
And were you thinking at all that the magneto-ionic theory and so forth
yes.
might be applicable to this?
Oh, sure, yes. I mean, obviously, with the Radcliffe's background, I mean, this was obviously going to be relevant, either because of the selective propagation of one mode versus the other, or the generation. Which, of course, we didn't think about generation at that time.
And while you were doing the nitty-gritty of building these antennas and so forth, were you also essentially educating yourself on things like magneto-ionic theory and the sun and such like this?
I think probably that first 6 months, no. I think we were too busy collecting equipment, and of course one was able to collect a lot of X-radar equipment, But was also building up the lab as a whole. You know, there weren't any meters or anything, and it was really remarkable how little there was at the end of the Six-Year War.
So just getting that established. But then after that 6 months, are you implying that then indeed you can begin to sit down and read some books about?
Well, I think again one's mental attitude at that time was quite different from what one expects. Of course, one was quite old. I mean, when 28 or something, I was. And so one wasn't in the sort of learning frame of mind. One didn't automatically go and say, I will study this problem and I will read it. All that's been done about it before. Because, well, A, nothing had been done about this particular part of it before, and if it had, nobody written about it, virtually. I think probably the thing, first of all, was to just look and see what there was.
Right.
Later on, of course, one tried to see what could make secular polarization, or what could make radiation at all, of course, initially.
Right.
But I think that came quite a bit later, I would say.
Can you say sort of when you think that, because that is a rather different change in philosophy, I would think. I mean, it's more or less when the science begins to get a little bit more settled, rather than...
Yes, I mean, or I should have thought probably that the first 2 or 3 years was very much, you were finding new things all the time so much that just to collect facts really rather a full-time occupation for a group of two people, or
right.
It grew a little bit after.
Well, looking at your publications here, I see that in 1948, Proceedings of the Royal Society, you talked about the theory of how this burst radiation might come about. So,
yes.
It seems that...
Well, obviously, during that time, with help from Radcliffe, one had begun. As far as I remember, Radcliffe gave some postgraduate lectures. Well, if you wouldn't really call them lectures, I mean, it was educating the next generation of ionosphere students.
See, for
a long time, the ionosphere side was a lot bigger than the radio astronomy side, and therefore there was this education for people starting work in the ionosphere, which we naturally listened to because clearly it was all relevant. And I suppose it was during those first 2 years that one gradually began to think about what might be the explanation.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very much concerned with actually building equipment, because I didn't buy things to get it back on in those days.
And like you say, virtually your entire source was just surplus radar equipment, is this correct?
Well, we had a little money. I think our first telescope cost $200. Which it was a good telescope. It got 50 sources.
Oh, you're talking about the Long Michelson.
Yes.
Okay, that's skipping a little bit ahead.
Yes.
Any estimate?
But up to then, you see, we'd built little frame things, broadside arrays, which we'd made ourselves.
Right. What about the idea of what is called the Ryle-Vonberg receiver, where you have a balanced noise and so forth?
Well, we started it right at the beginning. We reckoned that up till then, all we'd heard about was people that just put an integration circuit on the back end of a diode detector, and then tried to stabilize the gains of everything. Well, since we were, and this clearly worked, when you get signals so strong that they can swamp the receiver noise by a factor of many. But as we had set out to see what the radiation from the quark sun would be, and for all we knew there wasn't any, one wanted to get the sensitivity as good as possible. And it seemed clear to me that there was no hope of using this technique of a megaohm and a microfarad on the back end of a receiver, that you're asking for gain stable. I mean, the idea of bandwidths and things were, I think, fairly evident by then. I think we understood all that. Root of bandwidth ratios and things. And
did you know about Dickey's paper?
No,
for instance?
No. But it seemed that the only hope of doing this was to have a system which didn't require the gain stability of the receiver 1 part in 10 to the 9 or something.
It
was just hopeless to try and control the voltages. And, I remember reading about that time some of the early American reports which proudly said that their HT was stabilized to 1 microvolt and their filaments to 0.5 microvolt or something. And then we had occasion something went wrong, and I inadvertently set a 300-volt passed by to run at 400 volts by twiddling, reading the meter wrong.
Yeah.
And I went back and looked in the record and couldn't see. So we thought ours was a better method.
And
so we had, in fact, gone straight ahead for a system whereby you were balancing the antenna signal with that from a local noise source.
Hmm.
And that was the first observation we ever made with that system. We didn't attempt to make any observations. Well, actually, Ratcliffe disapproved of this. He thought we ought to make a crude receiver first and see if there's anything there. But I was very strongly opinion it wasn't worth doing. That A, people had done this sort of thing, and B, it was just too much hard work to try and do things that way.
So you were in favour of really doing it right, so to speak, taking longer if necessary rather than...
Yeah, well, it did take longer. We actually used a radar. RF plus IF strip, but right at the front of it we put a switch which incidentally came out of a German night fighter.
Oh really? So it was German surface equipment also. Of course, yeah. The Wurzburg was certainly German also.
Yes.
Well, let me ask you about having established that the sunspots were very small and therefore had fantastically high brightness temperatures, as we call them now, you did write this theoretical paper in Proceedings of the Royal Society in 1948, and then another one in the Proceedings of the Physical Society in 1949, talking about coherent electron oscillations had been proposed, but you had great difficulty in seeing how they were maintained. Could you just tell me what your view was at that time?
Yeah, it's a long time ago. This, we were. Yes, I think we're familiar with the concept of a temperature, an apparent temperature
role
of the thing. And then, or soon after, I think we realized that if this was going to be what you might call a thermal mechanism, you'd have to have a gas with particles of temperature divided by 10 to the 4, whatever it is.
Right.
And there was considerable opposition for, because, I mean, that was daft. We couldn't talk about temperature, there couldn't be such things, you see. So the only other way of doing it was to do like broadcast aerials do and move more than one electron at a time. And that was where the idea of of course they existed anyway. One knew in gaseous charged plasmas, this sort of oscillation was known to exist.
Right.
There were great problems in starting it up, and the great problem is getting it escaped, because it always happens at a frequency you just can't get out of the through the bound, which it doesn't matter in a plasma with it in a bottle, because the gradients are so fast at the edge, and
right.
It's a while sticking in, but it was clearly a difficulty, and that of course was a lot of the point of these early papers.
And also in the maintenance of what was keeping the oscillations going, I gathered from looking at the abstract, was were you bothered by that?
Oh yes, I mean the one didn't seem to have one might have had situations with dBdt in a sunspot field producing ways of accelerating electrons and the volts around in principle.
What did you say? dBdt?
Well, you've got a sunspot which is known to have fields of thousands of gas from
right.
The optical Zeeman split.
Right.
These sunspots are known to change in periods of weeks, and therefore there's a straight rate of change of flux calculation.
Oh, I see.
Which clearly gives you large voltages, so there's no great difficulty in accelerating charged particles, which basically is how you start off with a gaseous charge tube. But of course, at that time, even to today, there was very little known about gaseous charge oscillations. They were very mysterious things. Maybe they still are.
Well, just skipping just a tad ahead now, once there were a few radio sources, or radio stars as they were called then, known, you then, it seems to me, tried to extrapolate this to making these stars sort of super suns, radio stars super suns, saying that they perhaps had larger magnetic fields and that in the same way they could produce lots of radio emission and perhaps produce cosmic rays, which is rather interesting in the light of later developments, which likewise connected radio sources up with cosmic rays, but a rather different sort of thing, namely supernovae and so forth. Is that right, that this was just an extension?
Well, I think having got one mysterious mechanism for making intensely high brightness temperatures, obviously the one would tend to think of that as the explanation for these even more mysterious things.
Mm-hmm.
And there were stars were known with magnetic fields, general fields, not localized spot fields, of 5,000 gauss.
Right.
And therefore, there was obviously a supposition to be made that the sun was a rather feeble thing as far as magnetism is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
There were other stars which could produce very much more. And of course, this was the stage when one hadn't a clue what was making the galactic background either. And
right.
It was therefore conceivable that if there was a fair population of these things, they could explain the galactic background at the same time. But not a non-interstellar medium mechanism.
But accepted opinion then, I think, was that people were grappling with trying to explain it in thermal, as thermal radiation. I mean, they say, well, Jansky's measurement is somehow wrong, and then they tried to fit the rest of it to a hot gas. And apparently you didn't go along with that.
Well, I mean, I don't know. We probably hadn't thought about it very much until those early days were very much thinking about the sun. But I think when the sources were discovered, and these were also shown to be small angular size things and therefore very high surface brightness temperature things, the possibility that these could at the same time explain the other, and the trouble with the other thing is that the spectrum was such that there wasn't any hot gas explanation that really worked.
It was always straining to make that work.
Well, it was really wasn't even straining. I think it was hopeless. but the spectrum of the sunspot radiation could be this funny steep gradient, and would therefore be possible to fit to the galactic background if there were enough of these stars around,
right,
and the smooth that radiation could be enough.
I suppose the agreement of the radio spectrum of the solar burst and the galactic background was also suggested.
Yes, I mean, yes. I mean, it was this funny deep spectrum,
right?
Non-thermal spectrum.
But now, what about the nature of these stars? That must have been very puzzling. In this paper, you say that they must be very underluminous, and yet they're tremendously radioluminous. That was just something you had to accept.
Yes, I mean,
necessary consequence.
To make the discrepancy with the sun less acute, one would like to have them fairly near. In which case, the lack of optical, even with a crude sort of 1 degree or whatever it was accuracy at that time, the low optical luminosity was a worry.
Right. So you might have expected, for instance, that the half dozen brightest radio sources would line right up with Sirius and Vega and so forth.
Well, no, not necessarily, because they clearly were quite different things from the sun. I mean, they might have lined up with magnetic stars, which, as I say, there were quite a few stars by then known to have 5,000 plus magnetic fields, which changed.
But with 1 degree accuracies and positions, you could not.
But the point is that
they're not associated with individuals.
No, but there were a number of these known. You see, the number of these strong field stars were known, and those were at that time as rare as Sirius.
I think,
as far as I recall, we looked at those. There were only probably a dozen or so known, and they didn't tie up.
None of them tied up, I see.
But obviously it wasn't conclusive, because there could be a big range of the...
I see what you're saying. Okay, well, we've switched over into radio sources a bit here. Let me just finish up, see if there's anything more in the solar that I wanted to ask. Well, I guess the main thing to ask is, why did you switch from the solar? You had worked for a couple of years with several papers.
Well, I think probably the point was that we got quite a lot of observations going. Quite a lot of other people were in the field. It was now clearly becoming a thing which was going to get more and more theoretical. The interpretation was going to be more and more the major part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, personally, I didn't feel very competent to contribute there. I mean, you know, we put these fairly simple-minded ideas forward at the beginning, and they didn't seem to work very well. But this new thing, which was triggered off by Hayes' discovery of this fluctuating region,
right.
And we said, well, let's build an instrument to look for that particular object. Well, that was very exciting, actually, because we built this instrument and we left it running, and overnight, damn it, there were two of them.
The first night, yes.
We saw the record, which showed there was a source in the same place as Hay said it was, but there was another one, and that was how Cass A was discovered.
Right. I guess it would come in the first time you had the thing working.
Well, sure, it would. Yes, it was no declination resolution.
Right.
Yes.
Right. I'm wondering, in this paper, why you did not give a new position for Cygnus, because that was of great interest at that time. And
the point is the instrument was not really suitable for it. It hadn't enough resolution in the individual elements to sort out which was the correct, the central fringe. They were just as far as a 4 yagi, weren't they?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Aerial spacing of 0.5 kilometer.
Well, anyway, as far as I recall, we just got four rigged up four yagis each end, and connected together. Yes, it must have been, because we were able to do the polarization right away too, weren't we?
That's right.
That
that's
they weren't separately polarized like the sunspot radiation was.
I think you also tried to split the polarization question up into a steady component and a fluctuating component.
Yes, well, you see, the point about Cygnus was that it showed these fluctuations, which of course we now know to be the F region scintillation, and the fact that this one did it and this one didn't was primarily a function of time of day. But, these things have a marked maximum, one local time. And there was, I suppose, a suggestion from this that there seemed to be a little bit more fluctuation in that bit of record than this bit,
mm-hmm.
and that, but there was no clear interference pattern seen, and perhaps there was therefore some evidence that there was a little sunspot source contributing that much, which was polarized. But the general radiation clearly wasn't, because there was nothing showing here. There was just a bump showing the total integrated radiation, but there wasn't correlated between the two oppositely polarized antennae.
Now, going back to this business about, you say by chance, when you first observed, which was May 48, according to this 1948 Nature article, Ryle and Smith, by chance, Cass was coming through at a time when there was not so much scintillation, which is the around noon, is that right? I'm not so much up in my ionosphere.
Yes, well...
whereas Cygnus was coming through around midnight.
Yeah, because it's a very variable form anyway, it wouldn't necessarily... Well, at what time, where would it have been? These are GMT in a way, aren't they? So, yes, you said that is in fact 03 or something,
right?
And that's 07 and 06 in the morning. So, I mean, that
so Cygnus was coming through at 3 a.m.
Yes, yeah. So that's when there would have been quite a lot of this around.
But
it didn't always do it, that day, didn't.
Right. Now, how long did it take? I'm a little confused. I mean, one can look at the 1950 paper here, the Cambridge and Jodl observations next to each other, which most people say establish the ionospheric nature of these scintillations, but I'm confused as to when people actually were convinced that they were ionospheric, as opposed to this official date of March 18th, 1950. Or was there a lot of controversy up until this time?
Oh, well, no, you see, the point is that Hay had recognized this because of a variation, not because he could see a worthwhile bump on his record, because he had such a low-gain instrument.
Right.
It was a very small excess at this region, and it was all muddled up with a galactic plane. But the point is, in that one direction only, in one beamwidth's worth, he got this fluctuating signal. Now, I think probably one was already aware, I'm not sure if he actually said so, but I'm sure fairly soon afterwards one was aware that the fluctuating source means a source that is physically small.
Yes, he said that. Right?
He did. Yes. Well, I mean, if that was the right interpretation, because right away one's into the modern game of supernatural velocities or what.
But right.
I mean, at that time it was thought that, and therefore the possibility of this not being that, of being in transit, I think quite likely was around. After all, one knew about the. I mean, the ionosphere clearly had an effect at, this is 80 megacycles, wasn't it? I mean, the existence of, yes. of the spread F stuff was known, but I don't think that it was discovered. I don't think it would say, I believe this is the ionosphere, I'm going to do an experiment. I think it emerged, I can't remember whether we had this, Tony Hewish and I had a longish paper where we tied it all up with looking at four sources.
That's right, in 1950, a monthly notice.
Yes, but actually, of course, that was largely...
That was the result of...
Well, it wasn't much different in time, actually, because it was much, took a long time to publish in those days, but it was more or less the... this actually was doing more, though, wasn't it? It was talking about... Did it have long baseline experiments?
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Well, you see, the question was, was there something which was intrinsic in the source? Because we realised that was very important, if true. And so we did the combined experiments with Jodrell and us, and this one with 20 miles down the road,
mm-hmm.
well, no, it's less than 10 miles down the road, whatever it was. And by and large, there was no correlation, except for a few strange events. And of course, these are still with us.
I wrote a letter to Smith asking him if this had ever been resolved, and he said... No.
Well, you see, a lot of work has been recently by John Shakeshaft, in conjunction with, both Weber's gravitational passes. And cosmic ray shower bursts, which cosmic ray showers that they occupy. And could these things have been due to a higher shower thing producing And this was part of the Jodrell program. While they built the 218-foot vertical dish, originally it was to look for cosmic ray, the radiation from a cosmic ray shower. And there are high-altitude showers which might have produced correlation over these sort of distances. But as I say, this is a work that's been going on in conjunction with cosmic ray measurements, with ever-increasing baselines. We had a great program a couple of years back, going as far as Malta and all over the place.
I see.
Dublin and Malta, Jodrell, Cambridge.
And has this shed any light on what these things were?
Not really. It's all marginally significant, and one doesn't really know.
Because I, like I said, I wrote Smith, I guess it's been 2 years ago now, and he said that they were still a mystery.
Yes.
Well, something that, before we go any further with the science, we should mention that several more people were joining your group as you went along.
Yes, well, after Derek Von Berg, there was Ken Machin, Tony Hewish, and Graham Smith, I think. Was it 47? Well, 47 they came? I can't quite recall. Do you want me to look that up?
Actually, David Edge has given me
he's got the dates,
the cards with, yes, with the data on who joined when, but... Mm. But I'm just trying to get at now is these were all research students that were coming, rather than staff members.
They'd all been at TRE, as a matter of fact, and I was the last batch that completed their degree before the war. You see,
right.
And as soon as the war started, I think they converted to a 2-year, and I think maybe they tried a 1-year course just to give some people some basic education and get them doing something useful. And then when they came back, they then completed with a further year's undergraduate work and took their finals. And that was the case with Tony Hewish and Graham Smith. I'm not sure whether Ken Machin did the same or not. Probably. So, I mean, they at the end of the war, they had to do this extra year of work.
But then they continued with postgraduate study.
Yes. You all got PhDs, didn't they?
Right. Oh, you didn't?
No.
Why not?
It was too difficult.
Too much bother after...
Too all that physics to learn.
Yeah. That's very interesting. A question just popped in my mind, going back to the explanation of the radio stars producing cosmic rays and so forth. And what was your feeling as to why they were not bursty? Or did you think that the Cygnus A fluctuations could be intrinsic? This was 1948 again.
I think probably there was a physical society paper, wasn't there?
Yes. Right.
I think probably the feeling was that if you had a star which had a general magnetic field of 5,000 Gauss rather than the half Gauss of the Sun, you might get an analog of the quark Sun radiation, which was strong. You might occasionally get bursty things, but after all, the Sun much of the time isn't doing it. So you wouldn't. But of course, this, I think, must have been the back of our minds to explain these things. The fluctuations there before we knew they were atmospheric.
Right. Another thing about this paper that just occurred to me is...
Finish that off? I think the final... this was one thing, of course, showing there was a moderately convincing correlation, no correlation when you make the things further apart, most of the things. But the final thing, I think, was years observations of the four sources, which showed a very nice identical plot for all sources plotted in time of observation. So all our measurements were transit instruments, and therefore the right ascension determined the time of day which you observed it.
Right.
And they show this beautiful curve, which all was identical for all sources, and you shifted them all to observing local time, and they all fit in the same curve.
Ah, yes.
That ties it all up. All sources did this.
That it was a local solar effect.
It was clearly ionospheric. Yeah. It was in solar time, right.
That was Ryle and Hewish in 1950, right?
Yes.
Did you know about the Australian work going on in the ionospheric stuff at that time?
The separated receiver thing, you mean? It was probably going on in parallel, and I should think... I'm not sure. I don't know. No, I think this probably came out before anything they did. I'm not sure.
It came out before they did, yes. But what I'm wondering is, as you were working on this, were you aware of similar projects going on?
I don't think we were. I think we realized that between here and Jodrell we could do this quite nicely. I think we first of all did this short baseline thing and found most of the effect had disappeared, but we wanted to confirm it with a 20 kilometer baseline because we only had a little tiny portable receiver at 10 miles and we could get good signal noise if we went from here to Jodrell.
I'd like to ask you about the paper that has the discovery of Cas A, and that you have a source which is about 12 hours different than RA, and I've heard it said this was in the CAS A and the back lobe.
That's right.
Is that correct?
It's our combination CAS.
I see. And how did you straighten that one out? Eventually,
it was part. I think probably finally when we did the accurate positional work on CAS and Cygnus, then the lobes go the other way.
I see.
Well, we looked anyway. We had the vertebrae. We dip over. That's right. And you looked where that was, and there wasn't anything. But obviously, if you looked over the back, this is one of the methods we used for measuring position of CAS, and then we realized that almost certainly what was happening was coming in.
Right. And that's why CAS, you say, this more variable source than Ursa Major. It was variable because...
Because it was very low elevation. It was only about 5 degrees above the horizon.
Okay. Let me ask, I asked about the, knowing about the Australian ionospheric work, let me just ask the more general question of which groups you had contact with at that time, or...
I think probably one didn't have the sort of contact which has become, well, there were no conferences continued every few weeks, of course, like there are now, and the you relied much more on publication. I mean, I think the normal thing was to publish it, and I think most of us were in Nature anyway, so the delay was very short.
Right.
Clearly, when we didn't know, for example, of the Vare-Clift interferometer as a means for discovering the angular size of the source, and they didn't know of our Michelson interferometer.
Hmm.
And those appeared, I forget which order, but both in the angular diameter of sources and in the angular sizes of some of the radio sources.
I see.
They were just techniques which developed independently. I mean, they were half of them were radar people anyway, and they hadn't have a radar on top of the cliff which they could use. Going for scanning azimuth, and so you obviously could use that very easily, which is how they started. And obviously, when these first observations had been made, then we used to write to each other, and not particularly in the sense of a collaborative program, because it wasn't at all clear what the program ever was in those days. It was moving fairly fast, and you did what you could with the resources at your disposal. And
did you exchange preprints as we were on the
bench? No, you couldn't. You didn't have all these typing people around you. You wrote
to them. Didn't have Xerox machines.
No, no. I mean, it wasn't that.
I see. And any other groups besides the Australian? I mean, were you aware of the little bit of solar work that was going on, for instance, NRL in the States or anything like this? Or the French efforts right after the war?